The following program is brought to you by We Are Many. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out wearemany.org.
So I wanted to actually start with the current day context of the myth of the model minority and the Black Lives Matter movement. So I'm sure everyone in the room has encountered the myth of the model minority in some context or another. But I think the Duke University political science professor, Jerry Huff, do you guys know who that is? No? Okay. Basically, he summarizes it pretty well. Curry knows. In 1965, the Asians were he wrote this comment in response to an editorial about the Black Lives Matter movement, specifically in regards to the Baltimore rebellions. He said, in 1965, the Asians were discriminated against as least as badly as blacks. That was reflected in the word colored. The racism against what even Eleanor Roosevelt called the yellow races was at least as bad. So where are the editorials that say racism doomed the Asian Americans? They didn't feel sorry for themselves, but worked doubly hard. Every Asian student has a very simple old American first name that symbolizes their desire for integration. Virtually every black has a strange new name that symbolizes their lack of desire for integration. The amount of Asian white dating is enormous, and so surely will be the intermarriage. Black white dating is almost non-existent because of the ostracism by blacks of anyone who dates white. It was appropriate that the Chinese design won the competition for the Martin Luther King state. King helped them overcome. The blacks followed Malcolm X. So no, that's just the tip of the iceberg. So unfortunately, the Duke University professor wasn't the most notable person in recent months to project these ideas in the public. Most notably, Dylan Roof, the person behind the racist massacre at a notable Black Charleston church, wrote in his manifesto, "I have great respect for the East Asian races. Even if we were to go extinct, they would carry something on. They are by nature very racist and could be great allies of the white race. I'm not opposed at all to allies with the Northeast Asian races." So I'm sure everyone's initial reaction at this point is of outrage, which was my initial reaction. And if you're like me, you're horribly tired of hearing racist after racist use Asians and the model minority myth to justify their bigoted ideas. Or at its worst, justify killing black people like Dylan Roof. I wish I could just say that these were just ideas of the most extreme end of the conservative right wing, but unfortunately, the model minority is a dominant ruling class idea that continues to be upheld in the mainstream. Specifically, to pit Asians against blacks, as this was the main intention when the idea was first introduced in the 60s and gained momentum from the 80s onward. In fact, we've actually seen these ideas within the current Black Lives Matter movement, from Ferguson to the Baltimore rebellions. The mainstream media seems to be fixated on finding tensions between the Black and Asian communities. Time and time again, the mainstream media seems to waste no time attempting to make a story out of Asian-owned markets being targeted within these Black-led rebellions. As Jennifer Lee, sociology professor at UC Irvine, and the author of the book titled Civility in the City, Blacks, Jews, and Koreans in Urban America, the mainstream media continues to pit minority groups against one another to draw attention from larger structural problems that plague poor, disadvantaged communities by directing our attention to inter-minority conflict as it directs blame away from the structures that perpetuate gross inequality and toward individual problems. So, during the Baltimore Rebellion, NPR actually broadcasted a 5-minute story titled "Baltimore Unrest Reveals Tensions Between African American and Asians," which attempted to do just what Jennifer Lee references. Jeff Yang wrote a CNN editorial responding to this story entitled "Black Asian Tensions, Not the Cause of Baltimore." Everybody's been following, so I'm sure you know what the cause of Baltimore is. He highlights that, yes, racial tensions exist between Black and Asian, the Asian communities. However, the Asian markets that were damaged during the rebellions were located in impoverished neighborhoods and most likely attributed to collateral damage. In fact, NPR never actually interviewed the owners of these markets that were damaged during the rebellion. Jeff Yang did, and the owners actually expressed that they were still open for business and they received massive community support from Baltimore. In fact, NPR actually ignored the fact that Asian grocers, Asian-owned supermarkets, under the Korean American Grocers Association, in an effort to build community support within Black communities, started scholarship programs, distributed snacks to children throughout schools in Baltimore, and food to thousands of families in need, which the city government has failed to do. Mm-hmm. And it was only after the rebellion that they actually funded a free school lunch program for children. Yang goes on to say, and I completely agree with this, reinforcing the tired narrative of Black, Asian, interracial tension generates heat, but not light. There's a far more complex and nuanced relationship between these two urban populations, one that is an ongoing state of evolution, and it deserves to be told, not buried under cliches and clickbait. So, sorry, I didn't mean to get everyone upset. I start with these examples of how the model minority is used, especially in the context of the Black Lives Matter movement, as it will continue to be used to diminish any momentum the movement gains. More importantly, it will be continued to use to pit Black workers against Asian workers in a moment where solidarity is crucial to winning any major demands that the movement puts forward. As Frederick Douglass says, they divide both to conquer each. To reiterate, as socialists, we understand that capitalism needs ideology like the model minority myth to keep workers divided, as the biggest threat to the system is the united working class. In fact, it's no accident that the origins of the model minority, as it's directed towards Asians, comes from the mid-60s in the context of anti-colonial struggles abroad and Black power movements in the US. For people who may not know, the term model minority for Asian Americans were first introduced in 1966 in a New York Times article titled Success Story, Japanese American Style. The article argues that Japanese Americans have transcended prejudice and racism in US society as a result of their distinctly strong work ethic and family values. It continues to argue that these values prevent them from becoming a problem minority. I'm just gonna say, I really procrastinated on this test, so I'm pretty sure I don't fit the speech thing. So I don't think I fit the mold of the model minority, putting that out there. It continues to argue that those values prevent them from becoming a problem minority. A similar article about Chinese Americans was published in US News and World Report in December of 1966. These articles were written 1 year after the 1965 Moynihan Report that wrongly argued that Black poverty and inequality was due to the lack of a nuclear family and essentially placing the blame on single Black mothers, which we all know is a completely false and gross attack. Yuji Ichioka of the Asian American Political Alliance basically had this to say in response to the idea of the model minority. It appears ironically at the very moment when Sansei, so that's third generation, are asking what have been integrating into a nation conducting a politically and morally bankrupt war against people in the name of freedom and democracy, a nation bent on exterminating militant Black leaders, a nation which is moving to the extreme right in the name of law and order, a nation in which the so-called American dream has turned out to be a violent nightmare. His theme is totally out of touch with the hard realities of time. And in 1969, Americans still basically means racism, super patriotism, and right-wing policies. Unlike what Duke University professor Jerry Huff puts forward, Asian Americans have a radical history that was not only inspired by MLK, but also by Malcolm X and the Black Panthers. As Yuji Ichioka lays out, there was a group of radical Asians that did not buy into this myth, Not only the idea that Asians are hardworking, follow the rules, docile, I'm sure people can, you know, throw out other adjectives around the model minority myth, but rather they understood, as we do today, that American capitalism was built on slavery and continues to survive on the oppression of Black people. In other words, Black liberation in the US means the liberation of all peoples, including Asians in the US. So before I get into sort of Asian American radicals in the 60s and 70s, I think it's important to understand that, you know, radicals, we don't come out of vacuums. So prior to the 1965 Immigration Act, Asians were still largely excluded from immigration into the US. So also, the 1965 Immigration Act was pretty interesting, but I would argue that it was actually a win coming out of the civil rights movement. But in the context of World War II and the Cold War, and so like it was also to the advantage of the US ruling class to pass the 1965 Immigration Act. It's worth noting that after the institution of this act, that there was a large influx of immigration. I bring this up because it was after this institution of this act that dramatically changed the dynamics of immigration, including Asian immigration of mostly skilled workers. So after prior to 1965, Asians were largely excluded from the US. But then after 1965, you have a major influx of skilled workers that actually add to the argument of upholding the model minority. I won't go into too much detail about this dynamic, but wanted to point this out, that Asians were still very much second-class citizens in the US due to the long legacy of immigration and exclusion, which people should definitely read Richard Takaki's Strangers of a Different Shore if you haven't already. Go through immigration patterns of Asian immigration patterns in the US in extreme detail. Though this history begins to lay out the initial material basis as to why Asians and Blacks forged bonds of solidarity leading into the 1960s. If American capitalism is developed on slavery and oppression of Black people, it's also through these methods and tactics that American capitalism will oppress others, and hence the Chinese Exclusion Act, the many, you know, exclusion acts, the Japanese internment, which I'm going to discuss. So Diane Fujino emphasizes this point specifically with Japanese Americans and writes, "The development of an oppositional culture and consciousness resulted from generalized oppression and a particular geographically based form of domination, that of physical segregation." So basically she goes on to say that the two periods of time that Japanese Americans begin to develop this radical consciousness is through Japanese internment of World War II. And during the post-war years where residential segregation situated the Japanese community into Black neighborhoods or neighborhoods near them. So the Black community faced redlining, so did the Japanese American community. They also faced redlining and difficulty reintegrating after World War II. Yuri Kochiyama is a good example of this, as her radical consciousness began to develop during Japanese internment. After 5 months in Japanese internment, she wrote, "The Nisei, second generation, made good grades in school. Yet what happened when they got into the outside world? Racial prejudice and discrimination told them that the school worlds in the world were two different hemispheres, that what Caucasian teachers tried to instill in every student was only meant for the Caucasians, that the Black and Orientals would be looked upon, that obstacles would be many." So though Yuri Kochiyama was not a revolutionary during this time, it was her being in Japanese internment that helped her develop a radical consciousness. It wasn't until she actually moved to Harlem and became a part of the civil rights movement where she met Malcolm X and radicalized further through the Black Power movement. Yuri Kochiyama she's one of many examples. If you flip through, it's really hard to find like just one book on the Asian American movement, but if you flip through story after story after story of Asian American radicals, and even just radicals during the 60s and 70s, they all sort of were trained in the civil rights movement. And I think that's actually important to understand, especially under the dynamics of the Asian American movement. So most Asian American revolutionaries were active within the civil rights movement, including groups like SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, or CORE, Congress of Racial Equality. And so the rise of the Asian American movement in the 60s and 70s are attributed to three factors: the rise of the Black Power movement, the anti-war movement, and the Third World Liberation movements around the globe. As Daryl, this is actually the most comprehensive book that I found on the Asian American movement. It's called Rethinking the Asian American Movement, and actually writes about the Asian American movement in the 60s and 70s from a radical perspective. But he pointed out the Asian American movement emerged out of the 1960s and flowered through the early 1970s, a time when many social movements re-envisioned themselves as part of a worldwide multiracial struggle against racism and exploitation. I think what Maeda begins to lay out is really important as you begin to get a sense that the Asian American movement actually arose from not just a national movement, but a worldwide movement that was winning in a lot of ways. You had anti-colonial movements that they're winning everywhere, China, name a country. And then also specifically when the US lost in Vietnam. The dominant politics of the day that's consistent through all of these movements, Black Power, anti-war, and third world struggles, are attributed to the Asian American movement was Maoism. I think it's worth taking some time to actually discuss this or actually lay out what Maoism is. And I know it actually provokes a lot of discussion in Dennis's talk, so it could be fruitful for a discussion for this talk as well. So Tithi Bhattacharya, in an ISR article titled Maoism in the Global South, summarized Maoism best. Mao is credited with developing a strategy for revolution in non-European societies. These are four fundamental features to a strategic thinking. Underdeveloped societies have large peasantry and a small industrial working class. They also have long history of colonial rule in various forms. The social formation then can be characterized not as capitalist, but as semi-feudal and semi-colonial. It follows from above that the revolution cannot be led by the working class alone, but by an alliance between workers, peasants, and the progressive section of the anti-colonial bourgeoisie. The revolution itself must be in two stages. Its first stage, it must be a bourgeois democratic revolution to get rid of the feudal and colonial features, and then it proceeds to its socialist stage. Guerrilla warfare is, for Maoism, the single most important revolutionary strategy. This war is to begin in the countryside with a peasant army that will create red bases or liberated zones and eventually advance on towns to take power. So the quotes that sort of encapsulates that from Mao is, political power grows out of the barrel of the gun. So additionally, anti-colonial struggles also look to Maoism because it centered the most oppressed people at the center of achieving actual liberation, and not the working class. And these politics were winning. So Mao, China, Ho Chi Minh, Vietnam, Kim Il-sung, North Korea. I'm just gonna put it out there. I saw a picture in a book of a person raising a North Korean flag during an anti-war demonstration. I was like, wow, we're in a different time. And Che Guevara and Fidel Castro in Cuba and Franz Fanon, Algeria, and the list goes on. The popularity of Maoism in the US was also attributed to his continued critiques of racism in the US. In 1968, he stated, racial discrimination in the United States is a product of the colonialist and imperialist system. The contradiction between the black masses in the United States and US ruling circles is a class contradiction. Only by overthrowing the reactionary rule of the U.S. monopoly capitalist class and destroying the capitalist and imperial system can the black people in the U.S. win complete emancipation. Sounds pretty good. Like, we would agree with that analysis, actually. But, excellent. Knowing this history, it's understandable why Maoism was the dominant politics during this time. However, as socialists, we also have a critique of Maoism, primarily not centralizing the role and the social power of the working class. It was quite interesting going through the texts of the Asian American movement. Every first person history or every sort of historical account, it didn't actually address the working class. It rarely addressed this question. Though it did come up in some of the worker struggles in the 60s and 70s, this became a primary question around certain worker struggles in the Asian American movement. So the sort of the questions around these urban struggles that, or one struggle that faced this question was the garment workers in Chinatown. They had to face the question of, do you organize just the Chinese workers, or do you organize workers across, across races and ethnicities? Presently, I would also argue that it's actually more a question for us today, as the ruling classes of countries that have fought off Western imperialism, to some extent. I mean, obviously, there's still U.S. troops in Korea, in the Philippines, etc., Guam. We can go through the list, but to some extent, in their own countries, but at the same time that they're still fighting off certain U.S. imperialisms, their own ruling classes are actually complicit in instituting neoliberal policies that exist within their own countries. Additionally, these ruling classes also stoke regional imperialism to advance their own ruling class interests. So for example, the Philippines and the islands off the coast, they continue to have battles with China or Japan, both of them actually, that region is full of regional imperialism to advance their own ruling, the country's own ruling class interests. Also, I think the TPP is actually a really good example of the Trans-Pacific Partnership. The fact that it's aligning ridiculous amounts of countries, also in the interest of the ruling class, and off the backs of the workers, no environmental protections, no labor protections, yet it's continuing to be rammed down our throats. So the question of world mass movements centralizing the working class becomes an important one. And I just bring that up because I think it would be good to talk about Maoism, because I think people are seeing some sort of resurgence of it in its current context, and is Maoism sort of the politics forward for us in this present moment? It was back in the 60s and 70s, but not necessarily. I don't think it's the politics that we should move forward on. I think the politics of Marxism and centralizing the working class and is the way forward to socialist revolution. So it's important to note that the Asian American movement, so that's my aside for Maoism. Back to the Asian American movement, it wasn't really a mass movement per se. It mostly took places on the campuses and in the cities where there were the highest concentration of Asians. This was also during the time as Asians were beginning to build a mass identity for itself. That wasn't just about being Japanese, Chinese, Filipino, etc., but about being Asian American. And actually, I'll quote, so Yuji Ichioka of the Asian American Political Alliance, they coined this term, and they also coined this term to challenge the idea of Orientalism, like the racist term of Orientalism as well. Oriental. Thanks, Kitty. but with this creation of the Pan-Asian identity within the political context during this time, Maeda puts forward that Asian Americans within the movement built coalitions around not only a newly formed identity of Asian Americans, but also interracial alliances with other oppressed people in the US, which is evident in both the activism that took place on campuses and within their own community. Essentially, solidarity was at the core of the Asian American movement. So if there's anything that we could learn, and I think these are really important lessons for today as we face a fractured Black Lives Matter movement, or like a Black Lives Matter movement that has yet to take on the question of what actual solidarity means. I think drawing from the Asian American experience within the 60s and 70s is actually really important. So many attribute the start of the Asian American movement to the rise of the Third World Liberation Fronts that originated on the campuses starting with SFSU, so San Francisco State University, to UC Berkeley, and continue to trickle down to campuses like University of Hawaii Manoa, and even Seattle Central Community College. Leave us from Seattle. It was through the legacy of this successful student strike at San Francisco State University where we see the creation of an ethnic studies department, and we begin to see this win being replicated on other campuses where Asian Americans played pivotal roles within the struggle. So the San Francisco State University strike was actually the longest student strike in history. It lasted for 5 months from November 1968 to fall of 1968. It was on San Francisco State University is a working class campus, and it involved a coalition of third world students. So the question of solidarity within the Asian American movement, it was interesting. You read about different struggles, their immediate inclination is like build coalitions with other racial ethnicities during the time. And SFSU is a good example of that. So these groups consisted of PACE, the Filipino Action Collegiate Network, the Black Student Union, the Latin American Student Union, the Asian American Political Alliance, and the Mexican American Student Federation. And I also believe that Native American students also played a role in the San Francisco State University strike. So they drew upon the history of resistance by past generations. And the strike drew ideological inspiration from international revolution. So it's called the Third World Liberation Front for a reason. It drew inspirations from international revolutions occurring in Asia, Africa, Latin America, and the Middle East. Third world term, and this term originated out of the Bandung Conference of non-aligned nations. I don't have time to go through that. It's really good history. Sorry. But the Bandung Conference essentially represents the beginning of forging solidarity internationally between African and Asian countries gaining independence. Strike participants raised demands through a strategy of mass mobilizations and militant direct action, and it was actually fairly democratic. Like, they would actually vote. They would meet as a coalition and vote on strategy and tactics of the next day of how the strike was actually going to move forward. And it's through their coalition building and their democratic organization that they actually won in ethnic studies, the first ethnic studies program in the United States. And their ethnic studies demands included access to higher education for underserved and underrepresented groups, curricular revisions to uncover a buried past, and offered a relevant education to students of color. And it called for theories, practical policies, and skills to empower communities of color. I think in the questions of preserving the ethnic studies departments actually becomes a real question today. I don't know if I want to mention. I also think the other thing that San Francisco State University, it called into question fighting for affirmative action, which actually due to complicated racial issues, the Asian American, there's a right wing of the Asian American community that actually is coming against affirmative actions. So as radicals, we actually have to reinstill this demand and fight alongside the reason not only learning from the legacy of San Francisco State, but we want to fight affirmative action alongside Black students and other students that are fighting along for affirmative action. So, so that actually, like I said, spread to campuses through the US, and we started to get ethnic studies programs, affirmative action, like real demands were won out of that strike. And then, so just to, I also wanted to just briefly comment on community activism, because this is actually where the alliance between the Black Panther Party and the Red Guard actually, and the Red Guard, so the, mostly located in Chinatowns, actually come into be. It's important to understand that the where there was Asian American activism within the cities, they largely centered around Chinatowns, Manila towns, and Japan towns, largely created by segregated housing and employment practices during the late 19th to 20th century. This land, and then I'm reading this because we now we see that this dynamic is sort of playing out again. I don't know if people have been reading, but like, or the hyper gentrification. So I'm from San Francisco. Like the first thing that developers are after are like lands around our Chinatown that can be still bought out and developed. Lands around Oakland's Chinatown that, like, Oakland is even worse than San Francisco because that part of San Francisco's Chinatown has already been developed. But I also heard it's being played out in New York and in Boston. And the list sort of goes on and on and on. So you can understand like why, and now we're seeing, at least in San Francisco, some fights around anti-evictions. Particularly, the Lee family was a Chinese family in San Francisco that lived in the Chinatown. That was actually sort of, I would say it was sort of the initial fight against an eviction in Chinatown that actually built a coalition of housing groups around the area and brought everyone together to stop their evictions. They lost, but it was the basis of building a struggle around evictions in San Francisco. So the Red Guard Party, it was very interesting reading about the Red Guard Party because the Black Panthers actually met them at the Lee Wei's pool hall. It was like it was the place in San Francisco's Chinatown to actually talk about, or that's where the place in San Francisco's Chinatown where radical activists would actually go there, play pool, and talk politics. I was trying to think if there was anything like that, like in current day, and like it strikes me that like there isn't anything like I can't. Maybe there's things in people's hometown. But, so I put that forward because it was in the Chinatown, the Black Panthers convinced these Chinese radicals and convinced them to join their reading group. And from there, the Red Guard Party merged and with similar politics to the Black Panthers. So they produced a 10-point plan for the Red Guard. They made a primary focus of feeding the hungry in Chinatown, social services in Chinatown, because like I said, during this time, the Chinatown towns are completely impoverished. A lot of the urban activism actually did centralize around the fight against evictions and the iHotel. How much time do you have?
You have about 5 minutes.
Oh, man. So I'll just mention the iHotel. So it's actually one of the biggest fights in San Francisco. It was a fight against mass evictions in San Francisco, particularly within the Filipino communities. It brought together newly radicalized youth within the Filipino communities and Filipinos within the communities, mobilized a broad base from radicals to liberals. So it didn't just involve radicals within the movement, it was actually a movement that brought in liberals into, or progressives into the movement as well. The legacy that it put forward was a delayed eviction by 10 years, but most importantly, so like with the Lee campaign, what the iHotel does on a very much larger scale is it actually inspires other housing campaigns and sort of a real fight to fight for anti-evictions happening during that time. And it was through coalition building and struggle itself that highlighted racism and the exploitation faced by all under capitalism. So, to end, Asian Americans have a strong legacy in radical politics that completely challenges the model minority that I started to talk about at the beginning. But I think what I really wanted to emphasize is, and maybe this should come into discussion, but Steve Louie from he's a Bay Area activist, and he said, one of the hallmarks of the Asian American movement was to unite all who can be united, whether that was within the Asian community or within communities, especially people of color. This occurred because the movement saw the glass as half full and not half empty. We emphasize our similarities, not our differences, in order to build a new consciousness of who we are and what we stand for. And I actually think that quote is really important because, like I said, we're in a time where we're facing 30 years of neoliberal politics that has like basically smashed the confidence of the working class. And it's been really hard. I'm sure, like, I'm in the Bay Area, it's been really hard to actually organize within Black Lives Matter movement and actually bring up the idea of solidarity and what that actually meant. Even, like, the 60s, like, it was a knee-jerk reaction for Asian American radicals to actually create coalitions to try and win demands. We don't have that right now. And it's because of the defeat of the working class in the past 30, 40 years. So how do we rebuild that? Well, on what basis do we rebuild that? I was gonna read a long Alicia Garza quote, but I'll just paraphrase it. the idea of solidarity, I'll save that for later. But I think one of the other thing that I just wanted to briefly mention, one of the things that that I've been recently inspired by, at least within the Bay Area movement, is the formation of a group called Asian for Black Lives. Yes, they still have limited politics. They're, you know, leadership, top-down approach, secret. But when I organize with them, the fact that they're able to get Asians from Southeast Asia to Korea to, you know, just the get, like, being able to start to rebuild that idea of solidarity and then figuring out how to take that next step forward within the movement and reconnecting it to what our original fight backs were in the 60s and 70s, which is taking inspiration from the Black Power movements in that time. So,
the preceding program was a production of WeAreMany.org, a website dedicated to publishing radical and activist media that promotes a better understanding of today's world while also putting forward a vision for a better future. We Are Many is a project of the Center for Economic Research and Social Change. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out WeAreMany.org.